We're talking about emotional health this evening. And it has many different aspects, you know, from a Buddhist viewpoint. We would say we're only completely emotionally healthy when we become fully enlightened. Okay? In other words, enlightenment is a state in which we have abandoned all affliction, all afflictive emotions and disturbing inaccurate conceptions and attitudes, and developed all of our positive qualities infinitely. That's the state of enlightenment. And from a Buddhist viewpoint, we're only secure in being emotionally healthy when we're fully enlightened. Okay. What we're trying to do, of course, is go from where we are now to enlightenment. And so we get more emotionally healthy as we progress along the path. So in that respect, we all have some improvement to do. Yeah, and that's a little bit of a humbling experience. And I think it's kind of a necessary one to start off feeling like knowing that we are imperfect beings, knowing that we have a long way to go, and yet having that positive aspiration to be able to go there. So we want to start off from this rather respectful, humble attitude. If we come into something on emotional health, saying, well, I'm emotionally healthy, and I'm going to help all these poor slobs who aren't, then I think we're going to have a great difficulty actually helping others, because our mind is very afflicted by arrogance and pride. Okay, and without really realizing it, we are overwhelmed by it and mistaking condescension for compassion. Okay, so I think it's always good in these kinds of topics to recognize ourselves as a student or as a quote-unquote patient, so to speak, wanting to learn and to apply the teachings specifically on ourselves to start out with. And then, you know, we can share with others as much as we know. But the basic thing is, you know, for what we're learning to be a benefit to ourselves. Is everybody able to concentrate? Are you as challenged as I am by this environment? Okay, so we're all in it together, you know. Mine goes out to bump it up bump sometimes, and then we'll come back here. But, you know, what to do? They say that this is, where's my water?
Mm-hmm.
My water bottle? They say that this would be the result of karma, you know, that whatever we experience is a result of actions that we've done before. So clearly sometime in the past, we made a lot of noise that was disturbing to other people. So you remember all those times when your mother told you to be quiet? This was a warning. But it's good to think like this, because then instead of getting angry at what other people are doing, we see, okay, this is just a result of my own actions. There's no sense being angry at anybody else. Okay? If I don't like being disturbed by noise and blah blah in the future, then I need to be careful not to put that out into the environment that I share with other people and make them listen to stuff they don't want to listen to. Okay, so this is actually a very good way to learn from our experience and to prevent anger. Okay, now what was I saying? Okay, actually, I wanted to talk a little bit about contentment today, because, you know, whenever I teach the breathing meditation, and we'll do it each of the three evenings, I always encourage people to be content when they're doing the breathing meditation. Now, when my Tibetan teachers taught me the meditation, and when I learned it from Asians in other countries, nobody ever said in the instructions, let yourself be content. Okay? And I think that's because very often in those cultures, there's much more contentment than there is in our culture. And I started adding that to the instructions through reflecting on my own experience in meditation, noticing how discontent my mind always was. Okay? And when you're doing the breathing meditation, it's a very good opportunity, like I was saying before, to notice all these different kind of thoughts that are going through our mind that we sometimes just don't even notice. And this one of discontent is a real big one in American culture. I think in part it's fueled by the advertising industry. Is anybody here in advertising? Get your tomatoes ready because I'm about to insult your profession. That we pay a lot of attention to the media and to advertising, and the principal way to sell a product is by making people feel that they're not good enough in having what they have, in doing what they do, or in being what they are. So to create a sense of discontent in people, okay, and then to create attachment in them, wanting the thing that is going to fill the hole inside and bring them contentment and bring them whatever it is they think that they should have. So we are actually taught to be discontent. And in fact, discontentment is the basis of a healthy American economy. Because unless people are discontent, they don't buy things. Okay, and of course we want people to buy things, don't we? You know, that's how the country becomes successful. I mean, after 9/11, what were we told to do? Besides hate the Al-Qaeda, we were told to go shopping. Right? Okay? So we are educated to be discontent, to feel like there's something missing in our lives, and to feel that there's something out there that we've got to have to fill up the hole that's inside. So we often try and fill this hole with material possessions, so we're discontent in terms of what we have. We want other material possessions. We always want more and better. Okay, so we have to upgrade our computer. We have to buy a new car. We have to get more shoes. We have to get more clothes. We have to get new sports equipment. We have to have more money, you know. And this is the way, in fact, that a lot of people measure their success as human beings, is in terms of how much they have. And so, you know, you want to be successful, so you have to have so much. So then we feel discontent until we have that much. Of course, when we have that much, whatever our goal was, we still feel discontent because somebody else still has more, so then we need to go out and earn more. Because whoever has enough money, okay, whoever has enough possessions, nobody ever does. Okay, so there's this perpetual sense of discontentment in terms of possessions, and that fuels, you know, so much of how we live our lives and who we think we are and our self-concept of whether we're successful or not. We're also discontent about what we do, okay? Not only about what we have, but also about what we do. And so this is another aspect of our culture where we always feel like we need to do more than we're doing. Do you feel that in your life somehow? You know, we're always talking now about multitasking. Yeah, we should be able to do more. So you should be able to type and talk on the phone and do a third thing all at the same time. It used to be only mothers who had the perfection of multitasking, and nobody really appreciated them for that. Until multitasking became a buzzword in the business world, and now everybody wants to be like that. Of course, they don't credit mothers with being the ultimate multitaskers. How many of you are parents? You know what I'm talking about? Especially mothers, yeah? You know, you can drive and give your kid the bottle in the back seat and, you know, do multiple things all at one time, okay? I'm not a mother and I'm not a very good multitasker. In fact, I fail in multitasking. But, you know, people are expected to be able to do many, many things all at the same time. You know, that puts a certain level of tension on us, doesn't it? Because we're never able to completely give our attention to one thing because we always feel we should be doing something else as well. And so we make ourselves the busiest of the busy. There's an expression that one of my teachers, Geshe Nawandarga, used to use. Yeah, being the busiest of the busy. And this is American life now. Although many of you I see are from other cultures, maybe, you know, you're getting Americanized. I think maybe some of you should Asianize American culture and calm us down a bit. But, you know, we have this tremendous pressure here to do more and more. And so a lot of feeling of discontent comes up in terms of what we do. Just even on a daily basis, when we look over the day, over what we've gotten accomplished, so often we feel like I haven't done enough. I should have accomplished more. Okay. And in terms of our lives, we always feel what I'm doing is not enough. You know, I should have not just one career, but two or three, you know. Or I shouldn't just have a PhD in one subject, I should have one and two, you know, two or three PhDs, or whatever it is. But we feel like we should do more. And so this constant sense of stress because of that. And, you know, it might be interesting to do a little bit of analysis about where this comes from, you know, why we feel like we need to do more, and what of it comes from our families, what of it comes from our society in general, or from our individual professions, and how much of it have we internalized and bought into and spread to other people, you know. This philosophy of, you know, whatever you're doing, it isn't enough, you should do more. And how much are we teaching that to kids? Yeah. You can't just play soccer. You have to play soccer and baseball and cricket. And, you know, you also have to have art lessons and music lessons. And I mean, kids have so much pressure. When I was a kid, we used to go out and play in the dirt in the backyard. You know, now kids have to have lessons about how to play in the dirt. You know. Yeah. Because they have to learn to do playing in the dirt properly, you know. And not just play in the dirt. You also have to be able to memorize while you're playing in the dirt. Or, you know, whatever it is. Okay. Or you can't play in the dirt, God forbid, you know. You have to play with nice sanitized little objects, you know. I just saw a program last night that they took a lot of toys out of these vending machines because they had lead in them. I think playing with dirt might be healthier for kids than playing with some of the toys we give them. Anyway, okay, so we're dissatisfied with what we have, dissatisfied with what we do, and we're often dissatisfied with who we are. You know? Whoever we are, it's like we're not good enough. And I find this kind of a recurring thing as I work with people in spiritual practice, especially people from Western cultures, not as much in Asian cultures. But Western cultures, people have a big feeling of what I am is just not good enough. You know, that somehow I was born defective or I am inadequate. Or somehow I can't be up to standard. If people only knew what I was really like, they wouldn't like me because who I am is just not good enough. Okay? And there is often this way of thinking, this kind of self-concept buried in people's minds, and of course it, you know, impinges on all the aspects of our life because we come to everything with a sense of low self-esteem and lack of self-confidence. Okay? So again, you know, where does this kind of thing come from? I remember one time, backtracking a little bit, being in one of the conferences in Dharamsala where His Holiness the Dalai Lama was meeting with some Western scientists talking about science and psychology and so on. And one of the presenters was talking about how people in Western cultures had such problems with self-esteem. And His Holiness was completely confounded by this. And, you know, he couldn't understand it. And he was looking around the room. And this room was filled with people who were PhDs, you know, kind of the creme of the creme. And His Holiness is looking around going, who has this feeling of not being good enough? And everybody kind of looks at each other and says, we all do. His Holiness is just flabbergasted. He says, well, you're PhDs and you're successful in your society. You have a, you know, people esteem you and you have reputation and you have educational degrees and what society is telling you should have. Why don't you feel like you're good enough? Okay? So this started a whole discussion amongst us, you know. Part of it, you know, we trace to the Judaic Christian belief system of having original sin. Okay, so you come into the world sinful, not, you know, contaminated. It, you know, it could be because of the competitiveness of our economic system. There's a lot of different reasons, but it's an interesting thing to look at how, what was our conditioning that we came to feel that we weren't good enough. So in all three of these things, you know, being dissatisfied with what we have, what was the conditioning, you know, from our society, from our family, you know, and how much did we buy into it, and what are we perpetuating and sending to children, you know, in terms of what we do, where did that come from? What conditioning have we received that we feel that we aren't doing enough? And again, how much have we personally bought into that, and how much do we pass it on? How much do we judge other people in terms of what they do? And then third, in terms of who we are, where does this feeling of not being good enough or being inadequate come from? What was the conditioning? What is societal? What is from our family? You know? And to trace back this conditioning, see how much we've bought into it, how much we're passing it on. And then the big question is to ask ourselves, is it realistic and is it beneficial? Because just because we think about it, just because it's an ingrained part of ourselves, it doesn't mean that it's realistic or beneficial. Okay? Because we think and feel a lot of things that are completely stupid. Yeah? And I think this is one of the great gifts of meditation, is that we start bringing some wisdom to what we're thinking and feeling so that we can assess and discern and evaluate what's going on in our own mind. And by doing this, then we can begin the process of seeing what conditioning have we received that's valuable, that's realistic, that's beneficial, and how can we enhance it? What conditioning have we received that is totally unrealistic, non-beneficial, and how are we going to recondition our mind and recondition our life so that we live in a different way from the way that we were taught? Okay. Because that's the path to how to have some emotional health, is instead of letting ourselves be conditioned, to start being an active participant in our own conditioning, yeah, by retraining our mind or reforming our way of thinking. Okay. So instead of seeing our thoughts as given, well, this is just what I think, that's it. Or instead of seeing our emotions as given, I'm an angry person, there's nothing I can do about it. Okay? Or anybody in their right mind would feel this way in this situation. So instead of having these kind of predetermined conceptions about what we should think or what we should feel, okay, to realize that those kind of predetermined, or these conceptions, preconceptions, themselves are conditioned phenomena, and many of them are completely dumb. Okay? And so then to habituate ourselves with more realistic beneficial ways of thinking and feeling. And this is where meditation comes in, because in the Tibetan language, the word for meditation is gom, and gom is the same verbal root as to familiarize or to habituate. Okay? So you see that meditation is this process of familiarizing, habituating, retraining our mind to, so it goes along more beneficial and more realistic ways in terms of our attitudes and our emotions. Okay? So, a little bit of your homework assignment this week is to look in those three areas. Do some research, and if you want to, maybe jot down some notes, you know, about what areas you feel that you don't have enough, you don't do enough, you're not good enough, you know, and write down some notes about where this kind of conditioning came from, okay? Because sometimes when you can identify where it came from, then we can begin to sort it out and let go of some of it. Then one very simple way to start retraining our mind, and it sounds simplistic, but actually it's very hard to do. And let's take it with an example of with who we are. Okay, that one of feeling dissatisfied with who we are. To just say, who I am is good enough. Okay, it sounds very simplistic to affirm to ourselves, who I am is good enough. What kind of dumb, you know, thing is that? Am I just trying to brainwash myself? Okay, because I really know I'm not good enough. Okay, look how the mind is already thinking. You know, I can't even say the words to myself, I'm good enough, because my mind is so convinced that I'm not good enough. Okay, look at how the mind, you know, we get to this, to a certain thing saying, oh yes, I have problems with self-esteem, and you know, there's some hatred, and it's totally unrealistic, and I really want to let go of it. But I can't say to myself, I'm good enough, because really I'm not. Do you get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, how we inch so far, and then we self-sabotage. Because the preconception in our own mind is so strong about who we are. One of my teachers, Lama Tupten Yeshe, he used this phrase, you're good enough, dear. This is where I'm getting this technique from, because this is what Lama used to say to us all the time. Because he was Tibetan, but he was very familiar with how Westerners thought. And he always used to say, you know, you have pure quality. He said, you have poor quality view, okay? This was his Tibetan for low self-esteem, is poor quality view, you know? And he would say to us, you think you're poor quality, you know? But who you are is good enough. And he used to call everybody dear, so he'd say, who you are is good enough, dear, you know, in his Tibetanized English, which I cannot begin to repeat, you know, but... He had a special way of saying it. And he said it so much that you began to have a doubt that maybe he might be right, you know, that we were good enough. But then the old thought would come back in, no, Lama, you don't understand, really, we're not good enough. But he kept on repeating it, you know. And he traced back this... this thing of our poor quality view to our seeing everything as ordinary, yeah, and conceptualizing everything as ordinary. So he says you just look at everything and it's just ordinary, you know. Your friend is an ordinary friend and your parents are ordinary parents and you're an ordinary person. And you don't see any kind of divinity or any kind of potential in yourself or others. And so that's why you have this poor quality view, because you're just seeing everything as ordinary and as poor quality. And so he worked very hard with us to try and get us to see that we have some kind of potential to be other than what we are. Okay? And this is the theme of when he taught the Vajrayana or tantric teachings. This was very much Lama Yeshe's theme of revising our self-image so that instead of just thinking, you know, I'm little old me, followed by the retinue of self-criticism we have, we could begin to say, yes, and I also have this quality and this quality, and I have this potential, and I do this well, and I'm not the best one. I'm not going to be arrogant and proud about it, but there is some talent here that I have to offer, and I have these different potentials that I can increase. You know, I have some love and compassion in myself. I have some, you know, wisdom in myself. I have some gentleness, you know, because he said that we used to see ourselves in a very extreme way. And sometimes if we look at how we talk to ourselves, you know, we see that really how he described it was quite accurate. And this is another valuable role of meditation, because in meditation we get an opportunity to see how we talk to ourselves and what we say to ourselves and what our conceptions about ourselves are. You know, because a lot of these they aren't even conscious, we don't even realize. Okay? And so we begin to notice some of them, and then to just take some space and say, you know, okay, but that's good enough. Okay. For example, let me, you know, so that we don't get too abstract here. I'm in Madison right now because I'm studying with my teacher, Geshe Zopa, as a few of you in this audience are. And Geshe La is going through this very difficult Tibetan text all about the ultimate nature of reality. We have a kind of English translation which I have a very hard time understanding the English, let alone the Tibetan. Okay, so it's very challenging, yeah. And it would be very easy in the midst of this trying to understand a difficult topic with a poor translation, you know, and not being very good in Tibetan language to boot. It'd be very easy to just feel discouraged and to say, you know, I'm not good enough. You know, these teachings are too advanced, I can't understand them, or I'm not working hard enough, if only I worked harder, you know, I should have at least been able to become fluent in Tibetan in 1 year, you know, and we put all these strictures and expectations on ourselves, and, you know, pressure on ourselves, and it would be very easy in the midst of all of this to just say, it's too hard, I can't do it. Might as well go and, you know, go water skiing on the lake and enjoy myself this summer because it's just hopeless, you know. Yeah, I mean, understanding how this passage in the descent from, in the Lankavatara Sutra proves that something in the, you know, the, how do you translate it? Dasabhumi Sutra is definitive meaning, but the Sutra Unraveling Thought is interpretive meaning, and how that one refutes this one and this one and this, you know, and the 4-point outline, but there's only 3 points in the text, and, you know. And you could, you know, we could just say, look, you know, I'm totally hopeless and helpless. I can't learn this stuff. Yeah, and develop a whole image about this, about, you know, and why try? Yeah, it would be very, very easy to do this, okay? And so here is where I think Lama Yeshe's, you know, you're good enough, dear, is very important to remember, okay? That what we're learning, we're not expected to be perfect. We're not expected to understand everything all at the first try. That this is material that even the greatest of the great wrestle with, okay? And that we are planting seeds in our own mind just by hearing the words, just by attempting to understand, okay? That we're gaining some familiarity with the terms and the concepts. We'll have to hear it many times. As we do, we will understand more, you know? And to be content with learning what we're capable of learning on this first go-through of the material, okay? And if we have that kind of attitude of, you know, what I'm doing is good enough, I'm trying my best to follow along in this, sure, I don't ever understand everything, but that's okay, you know? Geshe La's not expecting me to understand everything. Buddha isn't expecting me to understand everything. Maybe I should stop expecting myself to understand everything. And to develop a sense of contentment and even joy of, wow, I'm trying. This is really hard stuff, but I'm trying. How wonderful. You know, and I'm just doing the best I can, and it will get better. Look, it can't get worse. So it will definitely get better. Yeah? And so if we think like that, then our whole feeling about ourselves changes. We feel more enthusiastic to actually put some energy in to study the material, whereas when we let ourselves get depressed, then we have no energy to study. So it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then we really do have a sense of contentment about how wonderful this is that I even have the opportunity to listen to this. And it's going to get better, you know, as I hear it more in this lifetime, more in future lifetimes, and how fortunate I am, and just have a sense of joy to be able to be there. Okay? And so that's a whole different kind of mental state, which creates a different kind of karma than the depressed, discouraged mental state creates. Then, of course, the energy that we feed to ourselves is different, of how fortunate I am to be here, instead of how stupid I am, I don't understand this. Okay. And so that influences, again, how much we learn, just by what we're telling ourselves, how we're thinking. Okay. It influences the whole energy of the group of people that are studying together. Yeah. Because if everybody in the room, you know, is going, oh, this is too hard, then we're just going to feed each other and we're all going to get discouraged, and then what good is that? But if we really feel, you know, enthusiastic because we feel fortunate to be there, then we share that energy with other people and we increase it. Okay? So do you get what I'm saying? That, you know, how much of it depends on our own mind and what we say to ourselves, how we describe things to ourselves, how we look at things, okay? And so the purpose, or the path, I should say, is to first notice what is going on in our mind, to start with, what's the raw material we have. Then second, to evaluate it, what's realistic and what's beneficial and what isn't. And then third, to realign our mind to a more positive and beneficial and realistic way of looking at things. And then fourth, to share that with other people. Okay? So this is kind of the path to contentment. Yeah. It's interesting to try it in terms of material possessions. Yeah. You know, when your mind says, oh, because the weekend is coming up, you know, oh, I should go to the shopping center and buy, fill in the blank, okay? Yeah, so you might, you know, you might fill in chocolate cake, you might say, you know, a new computer, you might say, I mean, do you have some ideas what you want to go buy this weekend? Okay, or you might have like the little, you know, mental shopping list. This is the advantage of being a nun, is like, you know, we don't go shopping, so you don't have to think about this. Yeah. It really helps you develop some sense of contentment, you know, because you just don't do that kind of thing. But you know, when the mind comes up with, oh, I want to go get, you know, whatever it is, to say, what I have is good enough. The mind says, oh, I want to go get chocolate cake on the weekend. What I have is good enough. I mean, I have brownies and chocolate chip cookies and oatmeal cookies and Oreos and everything else. Why do I need chocolate cake too, you know? I mean, what kind of sugar alcoholic am I? Okay, but to just, you know, stop the craving with what I have is good enough. You know? Maybe all you have is vegetables. Or yogurt. What I have is good enough. Yeah. I don't need to fulfill every one of my whims. You know. Or the mind comes of, you know, I've got to go up, you know, get a new computer, the one with the latest gadgets. Okay. There's some people who love toys, you know. I think people graduate from, you know, kids' toys to grown-up toys, you know, and grown-up toys are, you know, cars and computers and Palm Pilots and
this,
yeah, digital recorder. all these kinds of things, you know. So we have to get the latest thing with the, you know, the new feature on it. And to be able to say, oh, what I have is good enough. Yeah, my recorder is good enough. My computer is good enough. You know, if your computer doesn't work at all, okay, maybe then I can see something. You know, what I have is good enough. When the mind wants to go out and buy more clothes, yeah, go and look in your closet. You know, you have this thing, I want to go get, you know, a new shirt today. Go in your closet and count how many shirts you have. And then count how many bodies you have. Yeah, I mean, there might be 15 shirts for one body. Do you really need a new shirt? No, what I have is good enough. And then if the mind starts acting up with, but somebody else has more than I do, and I'm going to a party tonight and they've seen me wear this shirt already, then look. I mean, look at what your mind is thinking is important. Is that really important? You know, that somebody saw you wear something before? I mean, no wonder kind of the rest of the world accuses Americans of wasting resources and being selfish. Look the way we think, you know? We have to have a new something for every situation we go into. Okay? So try just practicing what I have is good enough. Yeah, my shoes are good enough, my shirt's good enough, what I have is good enough. Okay? Yeah? When the mind is starting, you know, Saturday morning, you know, you have your weekend checklist of all the things that you want to get done, right? You know, which of course is impossibly long. You know, you're never going to get all of them done. Yeah. So instead of, you know, racing around, you know, getting yourself all stressed out about on the day you're supposed to be relaxing, okay? You know, weekend you relax, so you get stressed out catching up on all your errands that you haven't done the whole week. Yeah. So instead of doing that, you know, take one or two things that are priorities, do those things, be satisfied that the rest don't get done. But instead of like just trying to get everything done and not setting priorities about what's important, just spend a couple of minutes thinking about, well, what is important, and do those, and, you know, give yourself enough time to do it, and then you feel satisfied after you've done that. No. And you don't have to do everything, because a lot of the things on our list probably aren't terribly important anyway. Okay, so just that this thing of, you know, lots of times in Buddhism they talk about being mindful, okay? So it means different things in different Buddhist traditions, but, you know, it can mean to be aware of what's going on in our mind, and it can also mean to hold in our mind our wholesome or valuable principles and goals and feelings. Okay, so if we want to be mindful throughout the weekend, try and be mindful of, you know, what I am is good enough, what I have is good enough, what I'm doing is good enough. Yeah, and like I said, really set priorities and don't build impossible expectations, and try and develop a sense of contentment. And see if you can then share that sense of contentment with the other people that you live with. Because yeah. If you are content with what you do and what you have and what you are, you're going to develop kids that are content instead of kids who are always going, I want, you know, kind of how it is, you know, I want this, I want that, everybody else has this, how come I can't? It's unfair. Yeah, it's first things American kids learn how to say is, it's unfair, somebody else has it and I don't, I want it, you know. And to be able, you know, if you model being content to your kids will learn, you know, what I have is good enough, what I am is good enough, what I do is good enough. And you might actually, if you develop some contentment, you might actually have some time to spend talking to your kids instead of rushing around doing a lot of things that aren't so important. you know. Or you might be able to actually have a conversation with your spouse. You know? Some people, it was so interesting to me. Shaoli had mentioned the Abbey. We have a monastery in eastern Washington state. And some people will come for the weekend, you know, to help us. And one family came, mom and dad, and then they had two kids. And they drove out from Montana. It was maybe a four-hour drive. And the mother was telling me, you know, I was saying, oh, that, you know, you really drove a long time to come here. And she said, actually, it's wonderful. It's the only time my husband and I have a chance to actually have a conversation during the week. We're usually so busy running here and there doing different things that we don't have a chance to talk, you know. So a four-hour drive was their chance to talk. I thought, wow, you know, how many other American families are like this where people don't even talk to each other, don't have time to talk to each other because they're all too busy. Yeah. And so creating this sense of, you know, of satisfaction frees you up to have so much more time to actually have a good discussion with the people you live with. Instead of feeding this sense of discontent that, you know, oh, I can't just sit and talk to a family member. I have to be out doing something. Well, maybe it's more valuable to really sit and enjoy a family member and to have a good discussion. Or maybe it's more important to sit quietly and read a book and be more peaceful yourself rather than, you know, trying to be the best of the best. Because anyway, whoever is that, I don't know. Okay? So this practice of contentment, yeah, I think is a very important one for emotional health. And to watch as you're trying to practice it, what, you know, you'll see the old conditioning come up as the mind says, no, I can't possibly not do this. Yeah? But I have to do this. And to look and, you know, do I have to do this? Do I really have this? Okay? So to start questioning some of these have-tos that we're telling ourselves and really see what's important in our life and what's not. Okay? Because the thing is that, you know, our life doesn't go on forever, and at some time the moment of death will be there. And what are we going to have to look back on? You know, a life of total stress in which we were never able to look anybody in the eye and connect with them because we were too busy doing more, being more, having more. Is that what we want? You know? So to really take some time and set our priorities and develop a sense of contentment with ourself in this world. And then that also frees us up for a lot more to be able to spend more time and energy on our spiritual practice and developing our love and our compassion and generosity and ethical conduct and all sorts of virtuous activities that will really benefit us in this life as well as in future lives. Okay, so that's just a little bit about contentment.